Hey everyone, it's Vicky. You may have noticed some changes we've been trying with Insight lately, and I wanted to fill you in. We are very excited about our new theme music. We're offering more Insight throughout the day on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And this month, to give ourselves the chance to catch our breath a little bit, we're going to bring you a half-hour version of Insight. You can still expect the same thoughtful conversations and topics every Monday through Thursday, but now from 9 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. Let us know what you think. All right, here's today's show. Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been 9 months since Sacramento voters passed Measure O in response to a growing unhoused population. The measure comes with many requirements, but essentially is meant to scale down camping on public property, and it can include a misdemeanor fine for those offered shelter and don't comply. However, rollout has been slow and frustrating for those who supported Measure O. Now, the City Council in Sacramento, they passed a series of new changes to streamline the process of opening up areas for those experiencing homelessness to camp, and they tightened rules for where they can and cannot go. But these changes, however, came with heated debate and concern by some council members, as the Sacramento City Manager, Howard Chan, now has the sole discretion to decide where these homeless campgrounds are opened within the city. Cap Radio's homelessness and housing affordability reporter Chris Nichols joins us with an update on how the city has decided to move forward. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicky. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having me. You've been following Measure O really since last year as it was making its way through the ballot. Can you remind people what Measure O was meant to accomplish and also the slow rollout that's followed?
Right. Well, supporters of Measure O say it was intended to be a first step, one that would force the city to get more serious about the homeless crisis. And as you mentioned, it does ban homeless encampments on public property within city limits and under certain conditions. One of those key conditions is that the city must offer available shelter space before it can cite someone or force them to move. And now, even though Sacramento has about 1,100 shelter beds, those are all usually full on any given night. So the city, for the most part, has been unable to enforce this new law.
Okay. Has anything changed in the past 9 months when it comes to enforcement?
Yes, there have been some changes. Last month, the city reopened 60 tents at what they call a safe ground camping site at Miller Park. This is a place where unhoused residents can legally camp without being forced to move. The 60 tents offered some new shelter capacity, and as a result, the city ended up clearing two large illegal encampments in Midtown because they had spaces they could offer people, though not everyone accepted those spaces. But, you know, the overall Sacramento still lacks the hundreds or really the thousands of additional beds that would be needed to shelter everyone living on the streets.
Yeah, the point in time count from last year was upwards of 9,000 on any given night. Right, Chris? In the county, not just the city.
Countywide, and it was a record high.
Yeah. So that brings us to the city council. Last week, they had a pretty heated debate. That city council meeting went many hours, and it was in response to the slow rollout of Measure O. So essentially, what was decided?
Right. I think it was a response to the slow rollout, but I think it was also, you know, it was an acknowledgement that Sacramento simply doesn't have enough tiny homes or safe campgrounds, safe parking spots, motel rooms, or any other location that might be used for temporary shelter, and that without those, without creating more of those, the city can't fully enforce its own laws.
And one of the more controversial decisions by the council last week, the council members, they narrowly approved the decision to allow the city manager, Howard Chan, giving him the sole authority to open sanctioned campgrounds for those experiencing homelessness in city limits. Can you explain that a little further? What exactly does that mean?
Right. And this was the most controversial idea. It was one that sparked a lot of debate. It was proposed by Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who eventually persuaded a slim majority, a 5-4 majority of the council, to support it. Steinberg said the goal was to streamline what can be a long, lengthy, contentious process of getting council members to actually approve homeless shelters.
Many well-intentioned people, including all of us sitting up here at the dais, tried to help manage the problem in your respective districts and me citywide, that there are too many cooks in the kitchen, that without providing a single point of authority to be able to make some hard decisions, for example, the decision we're being called upon to make here today around siting, progress bogs down. It just plain doesn't happen.
You know, Steinberg pointed to an effort 2 years ago called the Comprehensive Siting Plan. Council members then, they chose sites in their districts that could serve as sanctioned homeless camps. But that plan never went anywhere. Community pushback, high costs, and eventually a lack of political will caused it to fail. And the city only opened one of more than 20 sites proposed.
I remember that siting plan and it, yeah, essentially was stalled for those reasons. But even last week, there were some city council members. You mentioned this was a divided vote. There were council members who didn't like this proposal. So who was for this new addition, this new tool, and who was against it? And what was their reasonings behind it?
Right. It really split the council. Some of the newer members decided not to vote for it, but some of the ones that have been there for a couple of years did. Steinberg, along with council members Katie Valenzuela, Rick Jennings, Katie Maple, and Eric Guerra voted in favor. On the other side, council members Karina Talamantes, Mai Vang, Sean Lalowie, and Lisa Kaplan opposed the plan. They said they feared the new camps would be heavily concentrated in lower-income neighborhoods in their districts in North and South Sacramento. Kaplan, who was elected last fall and represents Snohomish, also said there wasn't enough detail in the plan and that the council was giving too much power to the city manager.
I can tell you I'm not in favor, as much as I think the city manager is doing a great job of handing him almost a blank check to spend up to $5 million as stated in the resolution for whatever he thinks is the right idea. The citizens of Sacramento elected us to be council members, elected us to make hard decisions, elected us to be accountable. And if we're not, then the voters have a right to vote us out.
Yeah, and the city manager is not in an elected position. And what Councilmember Kaplan is talking about, $5 million, I mean, that seems like a significant amount of money, which means a significant amount of power. Did the council place any limits on his authority to open these new sites?
The council did instruct Chan to create good neighbor policies, and those are plans that are intended to prevent illegal camps from popping up outside or near the sanctioned campsites. They also asked Chan to ensure the county keeps its commitment to provide social services at these camps.
When it comes out to the comes down to the services and the accommodations that are going to be required at these camps, what did the council agree upon?
Well, they really left a lot up to the city manager, sort of by design. And that freedom, that has some advocates for unhoused residents worried. They pointed out that the city has struggled in the past with providing basic safeguards at its sanctioned campgrounds. The tents at Miller Park that we talked about, they are on an asphalt roadway directly in the sun with no shade. There's very little protection at these sites from extreme heat, high winds, or rain. Bob Erlenbush of the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness spoke at last week's council meeting.
The city manager doesn't necessarily have to make it low barrier, doesn't have to be near transportation lines, doesn't necessarily have to provide a full array of social services. And we can do better than the bare minimum of a couple of porta potties and maybe a shower.
Okay, so at the center of this is city manager Howard Chan. How did he say he's going to approach it?
Well, he said he would meet with council members before approving sites in their districts. He also said he would use city-owned lots and would not place them in central Sacramento, where most of these temporary shelters have been located in the past. As far as timing goes, Steinberg said he hopes to see the new sites up and running over the next several weeks. Mm.
You know, a piece of this are several business groups. They were in support of Measure O. They also supported giving City Manager Chan this authority, as well as other changes made last week by the City Council. What do they have to say?
The message from many of them, especially those from Midtown and Downtown, was that Sacramento's homeless crisis threatens both public safety and the city's economic future. They strongly supported giving Chan this power. And also, they supported a separate plan approved by the council, which was designed to speed up enforcement at the highest priority encampments. Here is Michael Ault with the Downtown Sacramento Partnership.
You have charged me as a partner in the Downtown Partnership with economic development, with bringing people back to work, with trying to build a sense of identity for this community. We are losing the downtown core. We are losing our perception. We are losing the reality that this is a safe place to be. I think we've got a responsibility as a community. We've got a responsibility to not just the unhoused, but to the businesses, to the hospitality industry in this community to provide a safe space. We need to do more. We can do more. We should do more.
You know, Chris, there have been so many developments in just like the last week. I mean, another development outside of the city council, you reported on a ruling last week by a federal judge that could at least temporarily complicate Sacramento's enforcement efforts. What did the judge rule?
That's right, Vicki. I mean, it's been really busy when it comes to news on this topic. And last Thursday, U.S. District Court Judge Troy Nunley issued a temporary restraining order. It's an order that blocks the city for 14 days from clearing any homeless encampments, regardless of local laws. And the judge agreed with a request brought by the Sacramento Homeless Union that clearing camps during periods of excessive heat is harmful to unhoused residents. Charity Rodman lives in a tent right across from City Hall in one of the many encampments downtown. She reacted to the judge's ruling.
That's actually really good. I'm glad they did.
Yeah. And why so?
Because they're not doing anything to help get us off the streets. They say they've got all these resources, but you go to get them and there ain't nothing.
Yeah.
There's empty trailers that they've said, oh, well, the homeless can have this, this, this. They're all locked behind fences and they're empty.
Yeah.
We're all out here, and when I was staying over by Discovery Park, I had breakfast, I had lunch and dinner every day. I'd moved over here a week ago. I've had two meals.
But do they come out and remove?
And it's people that come out.
Yeah, yeah.
I so stayed here one time before, and we had people were coming out all the time.
Yeah.
We've literally had two meals. I've seen animal control more helpful than people trying to help people.
You know, a court hearing is set for later this week, so there should be some more news. That hearing should decide whether the judge should decide whether to extend that 14-day restraining order.
Chris, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Vicki.
That is Cap Radio reporter Chris Nichols. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The population of South Lake Tahoe is just over 20,000 humans. I say humans because there are upwards of 500 bears across the Tahoe region. And one in particular has become quite infamous. Wildlife biologists with the state of California have captured the bear formerly called 64F, but more commonly known as Hank the Tank. Turns out there are multiple bears identified as Hank the Tank by the public, but this bear in particular is a female with cubs and has been linked to at least 21 home break-ins in addition to other property damage across South Lake Tahoe since last year. The bear and her cubs are currently undergoing rehabilitation and veterinary care after attracting nationwide attention for its home burglary spree. To get a better understanding of what the future holds, we're joined by Jordan Traverso with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
So we are aware that the Tahoe area, it comes with wildlife, right? That's a given. And that bears are known to seize opportunities when it comes to food and homes, vehicles, campgrounds. But even with that, 21 home break-ins sounds like a lot, and that's not even including the other incidents of property damage. Is this case with a lone bear and cubs, is it extreme for even Fish and Wildlife?
Well, 21 is a lot, I will say, but it, you know, it isn't extreme. As more and more visitors continue to go up to the basin, there's going to be more and more opportunities for that kind of interaction. We really do our best to try to keep those interactions from happening, but you know, it's not just the residents, it's a lot of visitors to Tahoe as well. And unfortunately, if you're a kind of person that is very vigilant about keeping your trash secured and your barbecues put away, you might have a neighbor who doesn't, or you might have a neighbor who uses their house as an Airbnb or a Vrbo, and they have, you know, people coming in all the time that maybe don't understand all the rules. And I just really quickly wanted to say one thing about your opening is that while the bear cubs are candidates for rehabilitation, the sow, who we call 64F, she's not a candidate for rehabilitation. So she will stay in that sanctuary in Colorado for throughout her days.
That's right. The Wild Animal Sanctuary in Colorado, even the governor of Colorado tweeted saying that he welcomed, you know, Henrietta the tank. What do you make of the national attention that this has received?
I would make of it that people are incredibly passionate about wildlife. People just love their wildlife. Tahoe's absolutely no exception. And like you said at the very beginning, that, you know, there's bears there, there's wild animals all over. That's why people love Tahoe. That's exactly why you go there, because it's, even though there are large communities of humans there, it's still just a natural space. And because of that, it's going to be filled with natural things that are there, which are like bears and mountain lions and deer and all the things that you go up there to see. The issue of it is that with all that human activity, we actually as humans are the controllable factor. We have to do better. We have to do better at securing our garbage. If you have a fruit tree with fruit falling, you're responsible for picking it up. Bears are attracted to anything. We have this game that we play at kids' fairs where we have a bunch of jars and you smell what the jars are, and some of them are toothpaste or spaghetti sauce, or, you know, we have even like a part of a diaper in one that has a little bit of a smell, not a dirty one. But we ask kids what the bears are attracted to. Spoiler alert, it's all of them. Anything that smells, a bear is going to be attracted to. And so as humans, we really, really need to do better about making sure that we keep our spaces and our stuff secure so that they maintain a natural fear of us as humans. Mm.
I mean, there is, on one end, there's an appreciation and amusement with this, right? Because people love wildlife. But this is a serious issue. I mean, when it comes to making these decisions on wildlife, when to intervene, when to leave them alone, and when it's necessary to even make that tough decision to euthanize them, can you explain and walk us through how difficult those decisions are?
They're incredibly, incredibly difficult. And there's some sort of factors that happen. Every single situation is unique, and we do treat them all as a case-by-case scenario. But there's some factors, like if a bear actually attacks a human, that makes that decision, it's a little clearer. We have a responsibility to dispatch that animal if it's harmed a human in some way. This situation, you know, has changed over the course. Last year, we thought that we were talking about one bear with a ton of break-ins. And then as we got the DNA evidence back, we actually learned that there were three bears responsible for all of these break-ins. And the public had been visually identifying these three bears as one bear, saying, you know, taking pictures and saying, that's the bear, that's the bear, that's the bear. So we ended up, you know, the decisions, the factors that come into our decision-making are, you know, what has the bear done? What kind of deterrence did the homeowner take? What, you know, is this a repeat offender? This particular bear was also moved really, really far away, tagged and moved, and came back into the Tahoe Keys area. So those, you know, that definitely does show habituation and shows a lack of a fear of humans. And each one of these things go into that decision-making process. I will say we really don't We really, really try to not have euthanasia as a first option when we go and we have to make decisions like this. But there is not always going to be sanctuary space. There's not always going to be rehabilitation space for the cubs. The more humans interact and end up with a conflict situation, the more we're going to have to eventually make some really awful decisions. And even though 64F is going to a sanctuary, captivity life is not ideal. That's actually, you know, maybe it's better than death, but it's certainly not better than living out the rest of her life in the wild where she should be.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Jordan Traverso with California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Joining us now is 2G Silch. He is an expert on South Lake Tahoe's urbanized black bear population. Good morning, 2G.
Good morning, Vicki.
So you have been following black bears in the South Lake Tahoe area for many, many, many years. What is the main message you get from this incident of this female bear and her cubs?
Well, what we've been noticing over the last number of years is behaviors that are ramping up. In other words, throughout our community, we've had a number of what I would refer to as breaking and entering bears. And usually what those bears do is they look for the easy access. They look for an open slider. They look for an unlocked open window. They go down the street checking car doors to get into cars. But what's happened in the last few years is we've seen some behavior, and this bear that was just captured last week, Friday, is responsible for some pretty severe behavior. She wasn't looking for open windows and open doors. She was busting right through dead bolted front doors. She was busting through windows. And the other thing that she was not afraid of doing was entering buildings with people in them. That's kind of a scary thing. And if you think about the fact that a black bear has a sense of smell 7 times better than a bloodhound, a black bear knows very well if there is a human being inside a building or not inside a building, right? Because animals have their sense of smell is actually their sense of time, and they can tell how old a scent is. So that's a very problematic situation. I was watching her earlier this season with those 3 cubs on a property after she left her birthing den and moved to another property nearby. And on that property, there's 3 houses. One of the houses, she busted through 2 doors, busted right through them. And the 3rd time she went in that property, she busted through a window and inadvertently turned on one of the gas stove burners that was next to the refrigerator. Luckily, I heard that. I knew when she was out of the building, I was able to go in and turn it off, because I had been working with the homeowner. But those situations have become very problematic. And it's not there's any maliciousness on the part of the bear. That's not it at all. But those situations, with a bad, simple twist of fate, could have a very bad outcome for that bear and possibly a human. In the last couple of years, I'm aware of a couple different physical altercations between humans and bears just here on the South Shore. And it's, for those humans, it's a harrowing experience. I can't even imagine what they go through. You know, I'm very comfortable around bears, and I get them out from under houses and things like that. But the lay person doesn't have that skill set. And if they walk into a room and there's a bear there and they don't realize where that bear came in from, they may be blocking that space. And that can be a very dangerous situation. So that's the level of behavior we're seeing by some of these bears. It's just ramping up.
Well, 2G, thank you so much. And Jordan, I guess I want to end with you, Jordan. I mean, we only have about 20 seconds left, but what do you want listeners to take away from this? Tahoe is popular among locals and visitors alike.
So if you want to save wildlife and care about it deeply, then take some action. That means pick up dead fruit that's fallen, secure your trash. Do not take out your trash until the morning that the trucks are coming. Use bear boxes, find good bear boxes, don't try to make a contraption of a bear box. Get a real one. Bears are incredibly adept. They can look and they can figure out latches. They can figure out doors. They can take a door off its hinges. They know what refrigerators look like, and they know that there's food rewards in them. So just really, really be vigilant. Lock your doors, close the windows, just like 2G said. Cars too. Roll up your windows, lock the doors of the car. Don't leave food in the car. Just really, really do what you got to do to be a good neighbor to bears in Tahoe.
Jordan Traverso is with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and 2G Silch is an expert on South Lake Tahoe's urbanized black bear population. And that's it for Insight today. Have a great day. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.